Glory, glory, glory. Now we're in a real sobering part of the life and ministry of Jesus. Let's turn now to John, chapter 18, verses 2 through 6. John chapter 18, verses 2 through 6. We find right at the place where we're at, Jesus has just told his disciples who were slumbering to go ahead and keep on sleeping, and he woke them up. And so we see the revelation involved, and that is, spiritually speaking, when it's too late, it's too late. And Jesus had entered into his suffering. Now Judas probably first came to Christ and began kissing him. In John chapter 18, verses 2 through 6, we see what happens then right after that. And Judas also, which betrayed him, knew the place, for Jesus oftentimes resorted thither with his disciples. Judas then, having received a band of men and officers from the chief priests and Pharisees, comes thither with lanterns and torches and weapons. Jesus, therefore, knowing all things that should come upon him, went forth and said unto them, Whom seek ye? They answered him, Jesus of Nazareth. Jesus saith unto them, I am. And Judas also, which betrayed him, stood with him. As soon then as he had said unto them, I am, they went backward and fell to the ground. Then asked he them again, Whom seek ye? And they said, Jesus of Nazareth. Jesus answered, I told you that I am. If therefore you seek me, let these go their way. Then Simon Peter took his sword and swung at Malchus and so forth. Now, the revelation of what Jesus said is seen that he's in that he spoke Aramaic, or sometimes even spoke Hebrew. Hebrew terms, or close to the Hebrew. And the term I am in the first person is Eya. And you see that in the Hebrew Old Testament when God told Moses what his name was. And Moses said, Who do I tell them that sent me? And he said, Tell them, Eya, Asher Eya. That is, I am that I am. And this was supposedly unspoken except once a year in the Holy of Holies at this time by the Jews. So they didn't say it at any other time, and when they came into the Holy of Holies once a year, the high priest would pronounce that name. This is what the Jews would end up doing. And so it's probable that this is exactly what Jesus said, is Eya. Now remember, the priests were there with Judas, the chief of the priests, and some of the leaders. And they received a band of men and officers from the chief priests and Pharisees, and they came thither. And there was a guard that was from the temple, a temple guard, and so forth. And whether they understood it or not, still, when he spoke the name, the power of God flowed forth. And they were absolutely impacted with the presence of God and fell over backwards. It's interesting, the Jews came to, instead of saying Yahweh or Eya in the scripture, they'd say Adonai. Although often, what they would do is in the actual text, they would put Yahweh, but they would put the vowel pointing for Elohim. And that's where you get Jehovah. Yahweh comes from the vowel pointing of Elohim plus the lettering of Yahweh. And that's how you get Jehovah. But they normally would say Adonai in his place. Now, undoubtedly, they felt this overwhelming power just hit them. At this point, you can imagine the shock, the surprise. The Romans probably started calling on their gods. Mercury, Venus, you know, help! The Jews, they probably cried out to the Lord. Or they may not have cried out at all. They were shook. They undoubtedly made a lot of noise. They found themselves on the ground. Did they know why they got there? No. They didn't have full understanding. They just got there. So they looked around, probably dazed, shocked, possibly embarrassed. What are we doing on the ground? And they stood up. Jesus didn't say anything. He didn't say, you know what that was? He didn't say anything of that at all. It was just a manifestation of His Father. Were they in a place to receive it? No. That's interesting how Jesus is. He didn't rub a point in, you know what I mean? God does it, God says it, as it were, and that's all. He simply asked them again. He said, who do you seek? So they got up and went on with their mission. And that also included Judas. Judas fell over with the rest of them. So I'll let you know that he was on the wrong end of the stick at this point. The disciples didn't fall over, but Judas did. He had joined the company of the betrayers, of the murderers, of the destroyers. Now, as I mentioned, before he did this, he probably had kissed Jesus in greeting in Matthew chapter 26, starting in verse 47. While he yet spake, lo, Judas, one of the 12, came, and with him a great multitude with swords and staves from the chief priests and elders of the people. And he that betrayed him gave them a sign, saying, whomsoever I shall kiss, that same is he, hold him fast. And forthwith he came to Jesus and said, hail, Master, and kissed him. Now the Greek here is more literally, it speaks of it, it's in the aorist tense, but it's an intensified and an ostentatious kiss. And it's in a, because of its usage, the commentators say it means that he kissed him much fervently. There was a fervent kissing that he was taking place. It was ostentatious. It was very visible. It'd be like the very visible greeting, love greeting, that one would give to another when they really felt a lot of compassion. Here he wanted it to appear very outward, but there wasn't any heart at all. There wasn't any heart at all. In Proverbs 27 and verse 6, it says, the wounds of a friend are faithful, but the kisses of an enemy are deceitful. The same verb for this fervent kissing is used in Luke 7:38. Same verb. What a mockery. You know who it's there with? The woman that kissed Jesus' feet. The same verb is used in Luke 15 and verse 20. Again, what a mockery. You know what it's there for? It's the father receiving back the prodigal son and kissing him. And it's also used in Acts 20 and verse 37. You know what it's there for? That's when the elders of Ephesus said goodbye to Paul, thinking they'd never see him again. They fell upon his neck, kissing him. This was a common form of greeting. Interesting, the Greek word is phileo. It comes from phileo. So it's showing the expression of phileo. It was a common greeting of close friends and relatives. Possibly Judas thought it would quiet Christ and the disciples from panic. It also would set the soldiers at ease, possibly, seeing how approachable Christ was. Jesus didn't fight back. He didn't withdraw, run back into the woods. He didn't do anything. He just stood right there. They undoubtedly feared Christ, all these soldiers. I mean, seriously. Why otherwise would you send an entire band of soldiers, which equaled around 500 soldiers, totally armed? Why else would you send 500 after one man unless he was super dangerous? It's possible that they felt about Christ the same way many of the Pharisees did. In the Talmud, it talks about Jesus as being a magician, an enchanter, a deceiver, a wizard, a wonder worker, having the powers of Satan. Now, the Romans, they would have probably reinterpreted that as the power of the gods. And so Jesus was one that had the power of the gods, but he had the power of the gods to do evil. And that's, in their Roman pantheon, that's how that operated, see? There are good gods and bad gods. It's a whole lot. You know what it reminds me a whole lot like? The subculture of the comic book scene for young kids. They've got all these gods. He's, you know, the bionic woman, I guess, but I don't know. You know, all the different ones. I'm not up on it at all, but all the different ones. Spider-Man, and I don't know who the big ones are today. And so they undoubtedly feared him, and they probably would kind of withdraw cautiously with weapons ready. Judas goes up and begins to kiss Christ. And it's possible, also another reason why Judas did it, is so that he could hold on to Jesus while they came and grabbed him. And that was to ensure that Jesus wouldn't get away. The temple guards, they were the ones closest to Judas, and they could only have clubs. They were not allowed to carry swords. So they were the closest ones to Judas. And they would have preceded in front of the Romans. The Romans were there only if there was a backup needed. And they loved to fight. They just loved to slaughter a few Jews that night. Give them a little bit of thrill for all their energies. I mean, here they are sent out to the far-flung realms of the Roman Empire to these rabble-rousing Jews and trying to supposedly protect them when the Jews are probably the most cantankerous people on the face of the earth against the Roman government. What did Jesus do? Verse 50. Jesus said unto him, Friend, wherefore art thou come? Then came they and laid hands on Jesus and took him. Friend, meaning comrade or companion. He's reminding him of their relationship. You're my comrade. You're my companion. Why are you here? He also said in Luke chapter 22 and verse 48, he also said, Judas, betrayest thou the Son of Man with a kiss? Betrayest thou the Son of Man with a kiss? How low can you go? The highest of honor for the worst of actions, to betray Christ. But I'm afraid that's exactly what the church has sometimes done to Jesus. We've betrayed him with a kiss. We have, with a kiss, compromised with the world. We have shown that we are, quote, friendly to Christ. But in this friendliness, what we've basically done is denied the Spirit and only looked for an outward form that would build us up, build up our purses, bring money into our purses, merchandising on the work of God. And it's done with a kiss. Many times Christ has been betrayed with a kiss by his own people because of the compromise with the world system, the compromise with their desires all to build up our own kingdom, fill our own purse. Jesus also said in Luke 22:49, when they which were about him saw what would follow, they said unto him, Lord, shall we smite with the sword? But they didn't wait. Jesus was never able to give an answer. The sword was out and flashing before hardly anybody could know it. In verse 50 of Luke 22, and one of them, which was Peter, smote the servant of the high priest and cut off his right ear. And Jesus answered and said, Suffer ye thus far. And he touched his ear and healed him. In other words, allow it this far and that's it. Stop. No further. And then he healed him. Now it says he cut off his right ear and Jesus healed him. He probably just touched his ear. He didn't pick up the other ear. He probably just touched his ear. And in healing him, we don't know exactly whether it was just the wound was instantly healed or whether it actually grew back. Because to lose an ear, you're not going to bleed profusely. It's not going to be a real bleeding thing. More probably, the ear grew back in order to be really honestly healed in this situation. Because to lose the ear, you know, it's not going to just bleed profusely from the ear. And there's not a lot of blood. That's why your ears frostbite so easy, because there's not a lot of blood flowing through them. And that's why you can pierce your ears or bore holes in them, and you're not dealing with muscle and that sort of thing. And so he probably actually grew the ear right on back. So that means at one point there was an ear on the ground and two on his head. Now which ear is mine? It's interesting. That's exactly what we have done in trying to save Jesus. In standing up for the gospel, we come with such a defensiveness and such a pride and self-sufficiency that we basically take away the hearing of the people we're trying to convert. We cut off their right ear. Now, as you've heard it said, the reason why it's the right ear is because Peter undoubtedly was right-handed. And he came down with a sword to cleave the guy right in two, right on his head. But being a fisherman and not a swordsman, when you come down with your right hand, it automatically curves to the left. And so the guy ducked, and that brought his head down, and as it curved to the left, all he got was his right ear. Because that would be the normal action that the arm would take as you'd come down, especially as he'd duck, and his head would go lower, then all you'd get would be the right ear. And Jesus healed him. And he said, "Suffer this far." And he probably stopped both groups when he did that. Now you know that these trained Roman soldiers, as soon as his sword flashed through the air, you know what they did? I mean, they had their swords out. You can just imagine the sound of 500 men drawing their swords and seeking to move forward with lances. I mean, it could have been a bloodbath so much. But you suffer thus far. Jesus spoke and everybody listened. He seemed to be the center of everything. They all obeyed. They both stopped. Peter put up his sword and stepped back. Jesus healed the man. The Romans, they stood there and didn't do anything. Imagine the scene. It's kind of like what we'll see that happens at the trials. The real one that was on trial was Pilate. The real ones that were being dominated were the Romans and the other ones. Jesus was the center. He was commanding the shots. And then Jesus said one of the most amazing things in Matthew 26 and verse 53. Well, let me read verse 52. Then said Jesus unto him, "Put up again thy sword into his place, for all they that take the sword shall perish with the sword." Then he said this most amazing thing. "Thinkest thou that I cannot now pray to my Father, and he shall presently give me more than 12 legions of angels?" Now 12 would be the number of fullness in a kingdom. And you would want a whole kingdom to come to your aid, and so it was 12 legions. And a legion was the largest group of men in an army at that time, in the Roman army. One legion normally held 6,100 men plus 726 horsemen. So it was almost 7,000 per legion. Some places they have different figures. Some say as low as just over 3,000. But at the time of Caesar Augustus, the size of a legion was almost 7,000, including both men and horsemen. 12 legions, therefore, would be around 84,000. And he said more than 12 legions. That's a lot of angels. When Jesus said this, he pointed something out. He pointed something out that it was the will of God that he was submitting to, and not his own will. He could have ended the whole thing right there. He could have smashed down he could have leveled the whole city of Jerusalem himself. Yeah. By use of the angels. Just told them what to do. If he could have called them to his side, he could have done a lot of other things with those angels. But he didn't. He just let them take him. You know, it's one thing to suffer. It's another thing to suffer when you know you don't have to. And you know you don't deserve it. And you know you could stop at any time. Think about it. It's one thing to go through difficulties, say, in a relationship. It's another thing to go through difficulties in a relationship when you know you're being treated unfair. And that all you need to do is speak the word and you could stop it. You put people in their place. Jesus submitted willingly, according to the will of God. And then he says in Luke 22 and verse 53, when they came to take him over, after he said what he could have done, he could have stopped the whole thing right there, but he says in verse 53, actually let me read verse 52 also. "Then said Jesus unto the chief priests and captains of the temple and the elders which are come to him, Be ye come out as against a thief with swords and staves? When I was daily with you in the temple, you stretched forth no hands against me." And he's embarrassing them. He's exposing their folly and he's exposing their deceit. But then look what he says. "But this is your hour and the power of darkness." This is your time. This is the time that God has given you to do your thing. There's a time that God gives the devil opportunity to fulfill his plan. It's his hour. And I'm telling you, the final hour is going to be the day of the Lord. It's going to be the day of the Lord. Thank you, Jesus. Notice in Luke 22, verse 52, it describes who was there. It said, the chief priests and captains of the temple and the elders which were come to him. Said all of those that were there. And of course, the band of soldiers. Okay. And then Mark chapter 14, verses 51 and 52, something interesting is described. And there followed him a certain... And, well, let me read verse 50. And they all forsook him and fled. And that's referring to the disciples, every single one of them. Pointing out that though they said they were willing to die for him, and Peter proved it. He pulled the sword. Seriously, really think about it. He pulled the sword, and there was only two of them. We don't know who had the other one. Probably one of the sons of thunder. He pulled the sword against a band of approximately 600 people that were armed. You have to admit it. He meant what he said to Jesus when he said, I will die with you. Naturally, after the soul. Carnally. But he did not know the depths of what he was talking about. He did not know what Jesus was asking for because he was unwilling to die like Christ. Many of us are willing to die. Well, we'll suffer all kinds of things as long as we can go down swinging. We'll go through all kinds of things as long as we can fight back. But if we have to just stretch forth our hands and let another take us, if we have to just yield to the mockery and the embarrassment and the shame, we can't do that. We can't just die. We can't just succumb to the Spirit of the Lord and just die. And so they all forsook him and fled. Okay, death to self is the most difficult thing you'll ever do in the face of this earth. There's nothing more difficult. I don't care if you've climbed Mount Everest, if you've gone to the depths of the sea, if you've endured tortures beyond belief, the most difficult thing you'll ever do in this life is die to self. And you're faced with that decision. Verse 51, and there followed him a certain young man having a linen cloth cast about his naked body, and the young man laid hold on him. The young men laid hold on him, and he left the linen cloth and fled from them naked. Now, it just mentions that. Now, because he was naked under the cloth, it was not, therefore, one who had been with them all along. It seems to imply it was somebody that had just wakened up. Naked body probably also means that he had just a linen tunic underneath, because they often called that nakedness. And Don has taught, and I think it's probably the best possibility, seeing that it's probably not one of the disciples because of how he was dressed. Don feels that it was a caretaker of the garden who lived at the edge of Gethsemane. He was undoubtedly awakened either by Christ or by the group. And being a believer, possibly he came around to warn Christ of what was happening, what was taking place. And he got close enough to watch the whole thing going on. He undoubtedly wanted to help. But then they saw him and they ran after him, and one laid hold of his garment and he just left that and took off. And he fled around through the garden and came back around to his own home. That's probably the situation. Why he's included is really interesting. I don't know. But it's very possible when people like this are included, it's oftentimes because they later are part of the church. You know, they get saved later. I mean, they're mentioned now because they're of note later. And so it's writing about people that are of known later. You know, like you do in a story. Okay, and so at this point, Jesus is taken to the trial. So let's go through the trials of Jesus. Now begins a new section. In this trial, realize that your salvation is on trial. Your salvation is on trial. Because Christ had to endure this. We need to be able to endure with Him if we are going to enter into that deliverance and salvation with Him. The first place Jesus went was to Annas, the ex-high priest. We read about this, John chapter 18, verses 12 through 14. Then the band and the captain and officers of the Jews took Jesus and bound him. and led him away to Annas first, for he was father-in-law to Caiaphas, which was the high priest that same year. And now Caiaphas was he which gave counsel to the Jews that it was expedient that one man should die for the people. Annas was the one who really led the affairs around there. He had a very high position of authority in Judaism at that time. He was very rich. Four of his sons and a son-in-law held high priest positions right in succession. His fifth son is who put James to death in 62 AD. By that time, Annas was dead. There was no figure known more in contemporary Jewish history than that of Annas. He was the most known figure in contemporary Jewish history of that time. Remember how the common people, what they felt about the Passover? They called it the bazaars of the sons of Annas. Remember? The bazaars of the sons of Annas. They probably brought Christ to him first because he's the one that had power with the Roman praetorium. He was undoubtedly the one that gave the order that a band of soldiers would accompany the chief priests and the Pharisees that went to get Christ. It's interesting that the Roman guards left Jesus alone when they got him to Annas's. Because you see, Jesus had not at this time yet been guilty of any sin against the Roman government. So the Roman government really had no say in the matter except that Annas held a lot of sway. And with his money, he probably paid him off. Probably why he was able to do that. He was of the priestly class, and undoubtedly he was probably, if not the most instrumental, one of the most instrumental men in turning God's house of prayer into a house of merchandise. And the priesthood was made rich by the sacrifices. That's where they made so much of their money. And they basically, since they were able to choose whether your sacrifice was kosher or not, they basically controlled the sacrifices, and basically they had to be bought from them, and the prices would be exorbitant. To the Romans, Annas was a pleasant, helpful and man, and able to give them large sums of money. And he probably gathered all the chief priests and the former high priests together, and they had some sort of a lower council at this time. There were 23 seats there at Annas's palace. He tried to implicate Christ illegally by asking him questions and not by asking witnesses. And we see this in verses 19 through 23 of John 18. And the servants and officers stood there who had made a fire of coals. Wait, 19. The high priest then asked Jesus of his disciples and of his doctrine. Jesus answered him, I spake openly to the world. I ever taught in the synagogue and in the temple, whither the Jews always resort. In secret have I said nothing. Why askest thou me? Ask them which heard me, what I have said unto them. Behold, they know what I said. When he had thus spoken, one of the officers which stood by struck Jesus with the palm of his hand, saying, Answerest thou the high priest so? Jesus answered him, If I have spoken evil, bear witness of the evil. But if well, why smitest thou me? Now Annas had sent him bound unto Caiaphas the high priest. So we see, therefore, that he was there, and he probably wasn't speaking at first, but after all these questions, he basically exposed the illegality of Annas. And the officers were upset that he did it. But Annas was being totally illegal in questioning Christ and drilling him here, and it was at night, and it was a lower council. He had him sent to Caiaphas. We see that in Matthew 26, verses 57 through 59. And they that had laid hold on Jesus led him away to Caiaphas the high priest, where the scribes and the elders were assembled. But Peter followed him afar off unto the high priest's palace, and went in and sat with the servants to see the end. Now the chief priests and elders and all the council sought false witness against Jesus to put him to death. So we see that all the council, plus others, was here at the palace of Caiaphas. Now this was not their regular meeting place, but this was the high priest's palace. It was illegal to pass judgment at the high priest's palace, but this is exactly what they're going to do. Luke 22 and verse 54, a parallel at this point, Luke 22:54 says, Then took they him and led him and brought him into the high priest's house, and Peter followed afar off. Now the purpose of this particular judgment was to get false witnesses. And false witnesses had been hired either that evening or right during the night itself. Which is amazing, because here they are eating of the Passover lamb, and they're running around the streets getting people to falsely witness. Paying them money. Hiring them. Matthew 26, verses 59 and 60. Now the chief priests and elders and all the council sought false witness against Jesus to put him to death, but found none. Yea, though many false witnesses came, yet found they none. At the last came two false witnesses, and said, this fellow said, I am able to destroy the temple of God and build it in 3 days. It's interesting also, it was illegal because there was supposed to be a 24-hour period of rest between the seizure of a criminal and his examination. They immediately began to examine him, and they'd hire these witnesses. Now see, obviously you can tell it was sort of a quick thing. Remember, they just covenanted with Judas just before that. And when did Jesus go out to get them? Judas went out to get them during the meal. And so, you know, and then Jesus finished the meal and taught them, and then they went down to the Garden of Gethsemane, and already they were there. So there's only just a couple of hours there, a few hours. By the time that Judas left, to when he got them alerted, they went out, hired false witnesses, got the band of soldiers, got the chief priests together, went out to get Christ. I mean, all of that happened, boom, right then. They had to quick gobble down the rest of their lamb and take off. It's a mockery. And even these last two witnesses could not agree. In Mark 14, verses 55 to 59, we see them trying to iron it out between themselves. And the chief priests and all the council sought for witness against Jesus to put him to death, and found none. For many bear false witness against him, but their witness agreed not together. And there arose certain and bear false witness against him, saying, we heard him say, I'll destroy this temple that is made with hands. Within 3 days I'll build another made without hands. But neither so did their witness agree together. So it was getting kind of frustrating. Nobody could agree. And so what did they do? They probably were bending their law because of the urgency of the case. But we need to hire these witnesses. We need to get them in here because this is such an urgent case. We just need to get it done and get it over with. And it's for the expediency of the safety of the people. Undoubtedly, this would be the type of reasoning they would have used. Now, Caiaphas is super frustrated because it's not going according to plan. They had hoped by this time to have things so piled up against Christ it was obvious, but they didn't. And so Caiaphas did something that is contrary to the law. He put Christ under oath as the high priest. And he basically adjured Jesus to incriminate himself. Mark chapter 14, verses 60 to 63. And the high priest stood up in the midst and asked Jesus, saying, answerest thou nothing? What is it which these witness against thee? But he held his peace and answered nothing. And the high priest asked him, and said unto him, art thou the Christ, the Son of the Blessed? And Jesus said, I am. And you shall see the Son of Man sitting on the right hand of power and coming in the clouds of heaven. And the high priest rent his clothes and said, what need we any further witnesses? You have heard the blasphemy? What think ye? And they all condemned him to be guilty of death. And some began to spit on him and to cover his face and to buffet him and to say unto him, prophesy. And the servants did strike him with the palms of their hands. Jesus said, I am. Another place he said, you say that I am. Basically, in other words, that answer, meaning, you should know. You say that I am because it's obvious. Should be clear to anybody that's around me. And you should not see me. Henceforth do you see me coming in the clouds of heaven. That puts him with the Lord in Psalm 110 and verse 1, the Lord at the right hand of glory, who is the Lord of David. It also puts him with the Son of Man coming on the clouds of heaven in Daniel 7 and verse 13. Now they'd given great honor and glory to these exalted positions, and here Jesus was attributing them to himself and calling him the Messiah. But you know, the interesting thing about this is he just told the truth, that's all. He was condemned to blasphemy because he told the truth. And you wonder, well, what if the Messiah comes along that they agree with? Are they going to kill him for telling the truth too? You know? I mean, whoever says they're the Messiah, then they're going to immediately be killed, huh? So at this point he was condemned and he was mistreated. Spit upon, slapped, mocked, blindfolded, told them to prophesy against him, hit on the face. And so Caiaphas basically ramrodded this through. They had to quickly get Jesus into the judgment. The morning time was coming quick. They had to have him condemned and ready for death, getting him through the Sanhedrin and on his way to death. They had to have unanimity for the death penalty. If there was one person that didn't agree, they would not give the death penalty. So Caiaphas pushed it through. It's very probable that Joseph of Arimathea and Nicodemus were there to witness this. They were both secret believers of Jesus. They were probably there at that time, summoned with the rest of the council. And they say, well, didn't they disagree? Caiaphas just ramrodded it through. He just shouted out, who says he ought to be guilty? I do. And that's all he needed. Didn't ask anybody else. This wasn't going to be a clear vote. He was just pushing this thing through. Now, Peter was able to enter the courtyard, evidently. But according to law and custom at the time, the only way you could enter the courtyard of the priest was if some council member let you in. And so very possibly Joseph of Arimathea or Nicodemus let him in. This is what is supposed. In Matthew chapter 26, verses 69 through 75. Now Peter sat without in the palace, and a damsel came unto him, saying, thou also was with Jesus of Galilee. But he denied before them all, saying, I know not what thou sayest. When he was gone out into the porch, hoping to get away, another maid saw him and said unto them that were there, this fellow also was with Jesus of Nazareth. And again he denied with an oath this time. This time he vowed. He said, before God, I lie not. I do not know the man. And after a while came unto him they that stood by. See, now it was a whole group. And so they obviously had talked about it among themselves, kind of observing Peter. And they said to Peter, surely thou also art one of them, for thy speech bewrayeth thee. In other words, you are betrayed. You're a Galilean. Then began he to curse and to swear. So now not only did he swear by an oath, but he also began to curse, calling curses upon himself. In the Greek it's kata anathematizo. How do you like that? Have you ever heard of anathema? That's where we get the word from. And it means to damn to hell, basically. And so basically what he was doing is he was damning himself to hell if he ever knew the man. He was cursing against himself. I know not the man. And immediately the cock crew. And Peter remembered the word of Jesus which said unto him, before the cock crow, thou shalt deny me thrice. And he went out and wept bitterly. Thank God he went out and wept bitterly. Thank God that he didn't turn away. Thank God that he knew he was accepted even in the middle of his sin. There are many Christians that they go through condemnation. They hang themselves. If they sin, they hang themselves. They don't go out and weep bitterly. They don't feel that acceptance. And this acceptance was very clearly manifested in Luke 22, verse 61. See, as immediately while he yet spake, the cock crew, and the Lord turned and looked upon Peter. And Peter remembered the word of the Lord, how he had said unto him, before the cock crow, thou shalt deny me thrice. And Peter went out and wept bitterly. Now you know there's a couple of ways you can interpret that. When Jesus looked upon Peter, what kind of look was it? I'm telling you, it was the look of Jesus at that hour that gave Peter the strength to hang on. And when Jesus rose from the dead, the first one he said is, go tell Peter. God cares that our hearts be in a constant state of fellowship, in association with Him. Even when we sin or we fail, at that hour is when the grace of God more superabounds. And He draws us even more closely to Himself. This was not a condemnation like the Catholic Church or like others might think. When Jesus looked upon Peter, there was an acceptance. Realize also at this time, Jesus' face was filled with spittle. He had red marks across the side of his head. And he'd tied, he was handcuffed, held, probably pushed along roughly by soldiers. And he turned and looked at Peter. It was not a condemnation look. It was a look of acceptance. That's what enabled him to go through with what he had to go through with. Why was Peter there? Look at how desperately Peter was trying to please his Lord. He was going to die for Jesus. There was nothing going to separate him from Jesus. He stood up against 600 men, brethren. He was ready to be like Shamgar. But he fled. Oh, you can just imagine how he felt. And so now he's, is there anything I can do? Is there something I can do? He followed them all right into the hornet's nest. And you know he was scared by the fact that he denied. I mean, he was scared because he went right into the hornet's nest. But he so desperately loved Jesus. Then right in the midst of it when he denied Christ, if he had not had the look of Jesus, he may not have ever made it. He had to have the look of Jesus and he got it. Well, I'll tell you, brethren, when you've denied him thrice, Jesus knows. He'll tell you about it. He'll say that that'll happen. But he'll look to you and give you strength in that hour. So Jesus was passing out of Caiaphas's to the third part of his trial, and that was to this formal Sanhedrin council. This was held in the hall of hewn stones. The early rooster had crowed. It's still dark. It's still dark. You know, if you live out on the farm, those birds, they start crowing. That rooster will crow while it's still dark. But he knows that the sun is coming. It's not even light on the horizon yet before that cock will crow. He'll crow while it's still dead dark out there, but you got about an hour and a half, 2 hours before the sun comes up. So that gives us kind of an idea. And so he goes to the Sanhedrin council in the hall of hewn stones. Matthew 27 and verse 1. When the morning was come, all the chief priests and elders of the people took counsel against Jesus to put him to death. So here we have all of them. They're all gathered together. They're counseling to put him to death. In Luke 22 and verse 66. And as soon as it was day, the elders of the people and the chief priests and the scribes came together and led him into their council, saying, Art thou the Christ? Tell us. These were 71 members. 70 like the elders under Moses, plus Moses. So they had 71. It was called the Supreme Court of the Jews. It was the Supreme Court of the Jews. It was allowed by Alexander the Great. They became very powerful. They even dictated things concerning the Jews that were dispersed throughout the world. Jews that were dispersed in Egypt and Rome, they even dictated what they should do. They had tremendous authority. When the Sanhedrin was called, they would sit in judgment from the first morning sacrifice until the evening sacrifice, except on Sabbaths or feast days. But this is probably even earlier. Probably at 6 a.m., right at the very first trump. As soon as it was day, it says. So probably right at 6. And now that it was on a feast day, they'd just eaten the Passover lamb. And so they shouldn't have been there. But they probably rationalized, well, Jesus is dangerous. The ignorant masses must be protected. We've got to do this thing as quietly and as quickly as possible for their benefit. And this meeting was essential in order to pass a formal death penalty. There had to be an agreement of the Sanhedrin before they could pass the formal death sentence. Who was in the Sanhedrin? Well, the high priest, Caiaphas. The former high priests. Any privileged Sadducean families from which Rome would pick high priests. The elders. And the elders were the tribal and family heads of the people or of the priesthood. Also, there were leading scribes who acted as legal advisors and interpreters of the law. At the time of Christ, the Pharisees were evidently in the majority. But the Sadducees, they held sort of the supreme seats because of the chief priest. And the high priest, excuse me, and the chief priests. In order to be in the Sanhedrin, you must be learned in the law, science, and languages. And you also were required to have been former judges of the lower Sanhedrins. And of the 71, there was a high council of 3 men. The president, who was called the prince, he represented the civil and the religious interests of the Jewish nation. I'm not going to test you on all this. He represented the civil and the religious interests of the Jewish nation before the Roman government and before the Jewish congregation in Palestine. So he was called the elevated one. He represented them. And it was the highest seat of the Sanhedrin. It was not necessarily the high priest, although it often was, and here Caiaphas was. So he was the chief one in the Sanhedrin. He also summed up the votes and determined traditions. And there was a vice president under him, and he's the one that led and controlled the discussion. And then there was one under them, yet called the sage, or the wise one. He acted as a referee. And he'd put the topic of discussion into proper shape before they'd give it to the council. And these three would have 2 notaries in front of them, one to record the accusations and one to record the defense. Normally, the order of a trial was, first of all, to read the charges against the man. Secondly, to hear the witnesses. Thirdly, to cross-examine the witnesses to see if their accusations can hold up. And then fourthly, the defendant would bring his defense. And then he would also cross-examine the witnesses. But the defense, the one who was being implicated, never was obligated to implicate himself. The one that was being judged. Now, that's what was supposed to happen. But in Luke 22, verses 66 through 71, look what did happen. And as soon as it was day, the elders of the people and the chief priests and the scribes came together and led him into their council, saying, "Art thou the Christ? Tell us." No witnesses, no nothing. They tried that earlier. And he said unto them, "If I tell you, you will not believe. And if I also ask you, you will not answer me, nor let me go. Hereafter shall the Son of Man sit on the right hand of the power of God." Then said they all, "Art thou then the Son of God?" And he said unto them, "You say that I am." And they say, "What need we any further witnesses? We ourselves have heard of his own mouth." So, what they did is they just started right out. They asked him, and basically anticipating him to incriminate himself. And Jesus just gave it all that they wanted. He exposed his heart. He brought conviction to them, but they wouldn't believe. He exposed that you weren't here for truth, you're not here to listen, and you're not here to answer. So I'll just tell you, I'm coming on the clouds of glory. So they all condemned him for telling them the truth. It was illegal and it was okay to teach your own beliefs. In fact, it wasn't even necessarily a crime to claim that you were the Messiah. The only blasphemy would be if you used God's name in an injurious way. And they figured it was pretty injurious that Jesus would call himself the Messiah. You know why? Because he was injuring them. And so really, they really should have said, "We condemn you for blasphemy against us, because your speech injures us." Now the trial and the circumstances about it were illegal, and I want to give you 15 ways.
Wow.
Number one, it's illegal to arrest at night unless the criminal is dangerous or fleeing. And Jesus was not dangerous, and he certainly wasn't fleeing. It was illegal. Secondly, it was illegal to arrest without specific charges. And they had no specific charges. They had a hard time getting witnesses. Thirdly, it was illegal to fish for evidence to condemn a person. The evidence must come of itself. They fished for it. They went out and tried to grapple it to themselves. Fourthly, it's illegal to have a night trial. Here he had two night trials. One with Annas, one with Caiaphas, and it took all night. And now, right in the very early morning, with the Jewish Sanhedrin. Fifthly, it was illegal to try a person after he was arrested. You had to wait for 2 days so that the crime could be heralded around the city so that witnesses could come to the defense. Now, it's interesting that the Jews later started a fable that said that they did it. And it was done for 40 days. That people went around the city telling what had happened, that Jesus had been called and asking anybody to come to his defense, and nobody came to his defense. That's what the Jews said. But here there was no waiting, let alone heralding. Number six, it was illegal to condemn one on the same day they're judged guilty. Once they're judged guilty, you must review the evidence the next day after the emotions die down. Number seventhly, it was illegal to hire false witnesses, obviously. Eighthly, it was illegal to condemn without a unity of witnesses. There was no unity of witnesses. You can't condemn a person on just the statement of one. Ninthly, it was illegal to prejudge a case. You must be open to the testimony of witnesses. But here, there weren't any good witnesses allowed. Number 10, it was illegal to mistreat a person at the trial, even if his defense is rejected. And yet Christ had come from Caiaphas' palace over to the Sanhedrin with a red beaten face, and then he was hit more while he was there. Number 11, it's illegal to force a man to incriminate himself. And yet here the high priest used an oath and then immediately condemned him for it. Number 12, it was illegal for the older judges to vote first. The youngest judges must vote first so as not to be intimidating to the elder, and that the elder wouldn't be intimidating them. But here it's just the opposite. Plus, Nicodemus and Joseph of Arimathea obviously had to be pushed out of the picture. They obviously had to get kind of pushed over to the side and quieted down in order for them to condemn Jesus. Have a unanimous vote. Quote. 13. It was illegal to kill a man immediately. You were to give the condemned criminal one day to find peace with God before his death. The two that died with Jesus, they'd already been tried. They'd had their time. 14. It's illegal to hold a trial on a holy day. Yet this was the first day of the feast, actually, the 15th of Nisan. 15. It was illegal for the high priest to rend his garments, according to Leviticus 21 and verse 10. Although it's interesting, after this time, Jewish writers added that it was okay to rend your garments as a high priest if the reason was for blasphemy. And then you're supposed to rip it so bad that it's irreparable. So the Jews changed all of this, totally illegal. Basically, this wasn't even a trial. They didn't even have a trial. There was no announcement of a crime. There was no calling of witnesses. There was no allowance of defense from Christ. The entire outcome was already planned. It had already been staged. Pilate had already been summoned to be prepared. It was over. Now, evidently, about this time is when Judas killed himself. Matthew chapter 27, verses 3 through 5. Then Judas, which had betrayed him, when he saw that he was condemned, repented himself and brought again the 30 pieces of silver to the chief priests and elders, saying, I have sinned in that I have betrayed the innocent blood. And they said, what is that to us? See thou to it. And he cast down the pieces of silver in the temple and departed and went and hanged himself. And the chief priest took the silver pieces and said, it is not lawful for to put them into the treasury because it is the price of blood. He'd evidently seen what was happening. Many of the chief priests had probably gone to the temple at this time, preparing for the morning sacrifice, the things that should be done there. When Judas saw Christ condemned, the devil left him. It's just like the devil to do that. After you've really blown it, then the devil leaves you. Just sit back and look at it through the eyes you would have had before you fell into the deception. All in an effort to beat you down. He saw what he'd done. He saw how irrational it was. But he, instead of repenting, was still bound in that selfish lust. And so instead of repenting of the sin, he hated himself. That self-hatred that comes from that demonic bondage. And driven by demons, he rushed to the chief priests. They were supposed to pray for him. Maybe even offer sacrifice for him or counsel him. He was hoping to undo it. He was hoping to get Christ out of the fix. They wouldn't accept it. He said, well, I'm not keeping this money. This is your money. And he threw it into the temple. And when it says the temple, it probably means he went into the court of the men of Israel, and the priests were probably in the court of the priests there in front of the altar, and he threw it towards the holy place. That's probably what he did. It clattered all over those marble steps and stairs that were around the holy place. And that money, along with it, came almost basically the defilement of the temple, because that's all it was. That temple, right then, stood for the destruction of Christ, and it stood for the destruction of the true Son of God. And it had destroyed it. There was no true worship. They had brought the thing into merchandising. And so it was a fitting finale for that money. But they wouldn't accept the money. God didn't accept the money. And Judas now didn't accept the money. So he went out and hung himself. In Acts chapter 1, verses 18 and 19, it says that he fell headlong and his bowels burst out. Whereas here in Matthew it says he hung himself. And probably what he did is he ran to the area west of Hinnom Valley. And that's where it overlooks the town dump. He got out of the city. He didn't know what to do. He's probably driven in madness. And as you look across the city, you look across the Hinnom Valley, and over on the side there are trees along the edge. And then it's down into the craggy rocks down below. And he was probably towards the end of where the dump was. And where the dump is, where the fires are always burning, and they even burn criminals there. They burn the town refuse and all of that. And there's always fires burning there. He probably went over there, hung himself on a tree, and the branch broke. And he fell from that and burst open as he hit upon the jagged rocks below. And then it would spill out into the field, this area down south. of where the dump area was, and so that they bought that area evidently and added it to a cemetery and extended the area with that money. And so it's exactly what the devil planned happened to Judas. The death that he desired happened to Judas. And the whole thing is shrouded in death. Death of the temple. Death of the ministry of the temple. Death of the chief priests. The cemetery, that's death. Death in Hinnom Valley. Death to Judas. Death within himself because of his self-hatred. Okay, let's go.